The headlines: Iran's president says his country will hold talks with the U.S. within the framework of the 2050 nuclear deal once Washington ends its economic terrorism on Tehran. Fresh officials call for partial weekend lockdowns and a ban on public gatherings amid a surge in the number of people treated in intensive care units for COVID-19. And authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say around 3.4 million people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. Our top story for this half-hour: Iran's president says Tehran will sit down for talks within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal only if the new U.S. administration lifts the economic sanctions imposed by its predecessor.
The new U.S. administration should immediately stop economic terrorism operations against Iran. Such a move will open the way. That's the key to opening the door and holding talks together. We have no problems with that.
Rouhani added President Joe Biden's administration has acknowledged that the anti-Iran maximum pressure campaign by Donald Trump has failed. Therefore, Rouhani added the new U.S. government should abandon the policy. He then underlined it was Iran that preserved the nuclear deal despite scaling down its commitments in response to Washington's 2018 illegal withdrawal from the accord. The Iranian president says his country has been the only signatory to the deal to fully deliver on all of its commitments. He called on the Europeans and the U.S. to make good on their commitments, too. The three European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have called on Tehran to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In a joint statement, foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany expressed regret about Iran's decision to suspend the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty. In the meantime, the U.S. State Department spokesman called on Iran to work with the U.N. nuclear body. The comments come despite a deal reached between Tehran and the IAEA, which temporarily extends inspections of Iran's nuclear sites for 3 months. Iran's parliament passed a law last December which required the government to take further steps to scale back Iran's commitments under the JCPOA, including halting the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. The parliament's decision was in response to the remaining signatories' failure to keep their end of the bargain. Well, for further insight on the topic, we're now joined by research fellow at Chinese University of Hong Kong, Mr. Timothy Kurzweil, who's joining us from Hong Kong. Also from Tehran, we have political commentator Mustafa Khoshchashm. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kurzweil in Hong Kong. Sir, the Iranian president has said that Tehran will, in fact, sit down for talks within the framework of the JCPOA with the United States, but the United States has to end its, quote, economic terrorism against Iran first. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, I think what we see from the leader there is that at the moment, the United States likes to preach values around the world that it wants to signal a new era in Biden, that it's now promoting values and winding back the sort of great power politics that the United States used to play. But by attempting to conduct this negotiation with Iran without removing the sanctions, what they're really showing is an attempt to bully a smaller country into basically doing what it wants, which is the typical old U.S. playbook that's been in play for the last, 50 to 70 years, I suppose.
Mr. Khoshchashm, in Tehran, the Iranian president he mentioned in his statements that Joe Biden's administration acknowledges that the anti-Iran maximum pressure campaign by Donald Trump has failed, so why not reverse it?
Hello, thanks for having me. You know, this is pretty well important to note that what Iran's been doing, I mean, Tehran's stopping the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the NPT shouldn't be seen as a single move or a threat. But this heralds a trend that will be pursued in future. You know, the United States has long been looking for containment strategy when it comes to its foes, especially Iran, and it also includes the Russians as well as the Chinese. So they've been pretending that they want a conflict resolution, but there have been multiple agreements in the past 2 decades. According to Western officials and experts, Iran has always been compliant with the terms of all these agreements, including the JCPOA, but the U.S. has refrained from doing what was right, that is, removing the sanctions, because they are not looking for a conflict resolution, but they're just looking for containment, and they would like and they need to keep their weapon of choice, that's the sanctions regime against Iran, in order to pursue their JCPOA as well as other agreements that they want to contain Iran's regional power, Iran's nuclear industry, Iran's missile industries, and so on and so forth. So for quite a long time, they've been misusing Iran's loyalty and optimism with regard to conflict resolution. But after the U.S. exited the deal and the Europeans didn't comply with the terms of their undertakings under the JCPOA, even 14 months after the JCPOA was left by the United States, Iran started modifying its undertakings to send a signal that it would not stay under the deal for quite a long time. But at around September, Iran halted its modifications in order to give a final chance, a last chance, to the Biden administration if he wins the election, and he won the election. Now, 1 month later, after he came to office, he still denies what he needs to do, what's right, removing the sanctions. So as they persist in the same containment strategy, Iran has resumed, again, its modification of its undertakings. The remaining part was the surveillance and inspections under the additional protocol to the NPT, which has happened to be the most vital part. Iran was never willing to stop it, but it was forced by the U.S. persistent and continued sanctions policy against Iran. So this is the signal to the Western countries, especially Washington, that if they continue the same strategy, Iran has just picked up its active resistance diplomacy, and there will be moves in future in order to reciprocate costs that they inflict on Iran with costs. So from now on, there will be zero undertakings by Iran against zero undertakings by the United States and its European allies, and there will be pressure against pressure strategy, because the United States is stubborn and adamant to stop the economic terrorism or the sanctions against Iran. So I believe that the IAEA, other international bodies, as well as actors, the Chinese and Russians, they know what's right to do, and they need to pressure Washington to change its approach from bullying as well as containment against Iran to a conflict resolution. Otherwise, the era of free merits for the U.S. by Iran is gone now.
Let's go back to our guests in Hong Kong, Mr. Kurzweil. If you'd like to add anything to the comments made by Mr. Khosh Chish, he spoke of the canceling of the additional protocol. Give us your thoughts on that as well. He said that this is not the result of a single move. It all started when the United States unilaterally left the JCPOA, the International Accord. It's only fair now to see pressure against pressure, and also we should see other players in the JCPOA, namely Russia and China. They have to crank up the pressure on the United States to change its approach towards Iran.
Yeah, I think one important question that you brought up was the question of fairness. And I think, again, there's fairly clear evidence that the United States is not negotiating on a good faith basis at the moment, attempting to use this sanctions and economic leverage as a way of getting what it wants. And stories that the United States wants to strengthen the JCPOA beyond the original agreement is really just a sign that they're trying to bully and leverage Iran into reducing its ambitions in terms of energy security and regional politics. But then separate to the question of fairness, I think, is the question of, you know, hard power in politics itself. And I think we need to come to terms with the fact that we live in a multipolar world now. You know, the United States doesn't occupy the position of singular primacy that it did maybe in times past. A country like Iran has many options for diplomacy and trade and interaction with other countries, other important countries like Russia and China. And they're not really in a position to be bullied around by a single power anymore.
Mr. Khoshesh, give us your final thoughts on the issue as well. At this point, do you believe that the JCPOA can and will be salvaged?
Well, I don't think that the ball is in the United States court. And they still think that they need to pursue the same containment strategy. And they think that their only weapon is the sanctions. So it's widely perceived in here that Biden, no matter what happens, he will, go for some symbolic moves to pretend that the sanctions have been removed on Iran in probably March or April. They would go for some removal of symbolic sanctions, like the sanctions on the Iranian, foreign minister or the Iranian oil minister, Mrs. Zanganeh. Or they might even allow Iran to export 1 million barrels of crude to 1.5 million because Iran is already exporting 1 to 1.5 million barrels of oil per day based on tankers, trackers, as well as Reuters and other Western media outlets who say that Iran is bypassing the sanctions now, especially since midsummer. Iran has been increasing its petrol and oil products as well as crude exports to foreign destinations to a maximum 1.5 million barrels of oil. So he is not going to basically give anything to Iran, but he would go for some symbolic removal of sanctions, but not genuine ones. Exactly like what Obama did. He was the first violator of the nuclear deal when ISA was reimposed, not extended, but reimposed on Iran at the beginning of the implementation of the JCPOA, and he never allowed Iran to enjoy the merits. That was a major breach, a significant breach of the JCPOA as stated in the nuclear deal itself in paragraphs 25 and 26. The EU and the U.S. should try their best in order to allow Iran to receive the maximum merits under the nuclear deal, but they never did that, and they never allowed Iran to enjoy anything more than probably 3-4% of the economic merits that they vowed under the nuclear deal. Biden means to do the same. He is not going to remove the sanctions effectively. He is going to go maximum for some kind of symbolic moves, as I explained earlier. Therefore, Tehran has made it very much clear, the Iranian parliament, the Iranian supreme leader, the Iranian Supreme National Security Council, as well as the Iranian government, they have all stressed that such moves are not going to work. Tehran may not resume its undertakings for anything less than a complete removal of all sanctions imposed on the nation in the past 4 years, ever since Donald Trump took office. Biden should give it a second thought if they mean to go for this kind of agenda. I believe it will be a total failure, especially considering that President Rouhani's second term is going to end in about a few months from now, and they need to work with a new government, which is widely believed to be a principalist government, a government from the revolutionary camp. So I believe that unless we see a revolutionary move by the Biden administration to call off the sanctions that they imposed in the past 4 years and return to the full compliance with the JCPOA, then the JCPOA may not be revived or it might be called off altogether.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Political commentator Mostafa Khoshesh joining us from Tehran. Also thanks to Mr. Timothy Kurzweil joining us from Hong Kong. Officials in France have called for a ban on public gatherings and partial weekend lockdowns as a number of countries' COVID-19 intensive care patients rose to a 12-week high of over 3,400. Regional authorities called for the restrictions as Paris continues to resist a new national lockdown to control more contagious variants of the coronavirus. The country has recorded over 20,000 new infections and 431 deaths. The figures raise the total cases to more than 3.6 million and the death toll to over 85,000. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said her country is now in a third wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Merkel also noted that the slow vaccination rollout and the risk of major outbreaks of fast-spreading variants have made an easing of restrictions introduced late last year even more difficult. Afghanistan has started its first COVID-19 vaccinations, administering dozens, rather doses, first to security forces, healthcare workers, and journalists. The campaign comes amid a sharp rise in violence in the war-torn country. Amin Alami reports.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans that make nearly a third of the population might have been infected with the coronavirus. Nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far. Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say around 3.4 people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. The authorities said over 200 counties were reporting water issues as of Tuesday evening. The number was much lower compared to Monday, when over 7.9 million people faced water disruptions. The freezing weather conditions left dozens dead and knocked out power stations in Texas. It took several days for the authorities to restore power. Fresh water and food have been distributed to residents, with long queues formed in some locations to receive the supplies. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to call Saudi Arabia's King Salman as an American intelligence report on the murder of prominent journalist Jamal Khashoggi is about to come out. The Wednesday call would be the first talk between Biden as U.S. president and King Salman. A U.S. media outlet says Khashoggi's case would be a hot topic of their conversation. According to the Axios, a report by the U.S. Director of National Intelligence could put one of the king's sons in a difficult situation. The unclassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in Khashoggi's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and strong critic of Saudi government policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel. Anti-Semitism has been widely used to slander all those who do not agree with Israel in whatever the case might be. But now, Israeli officials are being accused of anti-Semitism. New videos have been recently released by Israeli officials that actually mocks other Israelis and Jews in ways that can only be explained as anti-Semitic. The term has gained widespread popularity on an international level, mainly due to wide use, or some now say abuse, of the word by Israeli officials themselves to justify pretty much everything they do, from internal policy to external policy. But for Israeli officials, the term doesn't come any more handy than when others are criticizing them. When Israel is criticized, it automatically uses the anti-Semitic card to slander others. But what happens if the table is turned? We've all heard of Israeli officials and the regime in general call anyone that points to their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and their dysfunctional system as anti-Semitic. But activists from the non-for-profit U.S.-based Electronic Intifada online newspaper have found that the Israeli regime, in its nature, is actually anti-Semitic. According to the Electronic Intifada, Israel's new ambassador to the U.K. stereotyped a Jewish human rights group in anti-Semitic terms in a video she released as part of a campaign for a political party. In a Hebrew YouTube video, Israeli Ambassador Zipi Hotoveli mocked breaking the silence as being motivated by money. The video depicts Jews as greedy. According to Jews Worldwide, and of course Israel, depictions of Jews as being greedy is a major theme in the history of anti-Semitic stereotypes. Breaking the Silence, by the way, is an Israeli NGO established in 2004 by veterans of the Israel military and aims to shed light on the cruelty of the Israeli occupation in occupied Palestinian territories. The video also targets Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem, calling them extreme left, and accuses them of receiving funding from the European Union and being agents of the EU. The video calls on the extreme right to attack these organizations so that their funding will cease to exist.
Anti-Semitism is basically a system that is designed to suppress all forms of criticism of Israel, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish politics, or should I say, everything Jewish. Whether there is really hatred toward Jews for being Jews in the world, I actually hardly believe it. I think that a lot of people oppose Israel, and for a good reason, and it should be legitimate. A lot of people oppose some aspect of Jewish culture, aspect of Judaism, definitely aspect of Jewish politics, and all of that should be totally legitimized. As long as we don't hate people for being a people, I think that all criticism should be considered legitimate. I think that it is way more than Israel. It's the answer is obviously yes, but it's not just Israel. This is something that we see throughout the entire spectrum of Jewish politics, and it's not just Jewish politics. We can see that all over the world, politicians are weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to serve their own interests. We saw it in Britain in the case of Jeremy Corbyn. We saw it in the American election. Both sides accuse the other of anti-Semitism. And it's pretty, meaningless, because really you cannot find a single voice in the political arena, in the arts, in academia, who criticizes Jews for being Jews. Again, people criticize Jews legitimately for politics, for culture, for Israeli politics. You have to remind you that Israel calls itself the Jewish state and claims to represent world Jews. Whether it is true or not is another question.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic. Anak sarcastically says, people are calling Beteslim anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis. CEO of Corn says, but it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive.
Shameful what Israel has done and the supporters of Israel have done in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in these modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the State of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of anti-Semitism. Could say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism, a very real danger
with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses, we dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who are we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotavelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year, in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achiel Membe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The state of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, as same as you can say to other states. The countries in the world, they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights. And you have to, if you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth. So maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semites. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and greed and all these things. And if they are socialists, they say that they are communists, like it still used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros, He's an Hungarian from Hungary, liberal Jew, that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur Bet Eslam through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term, an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodor Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile towards Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish, but of course oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews, so it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term, anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not, at the moment, Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so, ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. Ultra-Orthodox Jews accuse the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Police officers were pelted with stones as they arrived at an independent Haredi school in Beit Shemesh that was opened despite the regime-mandated closure of all academic institutions during the current lockdown. Israel police said the volunteer fired into the air as he believed his life was in danger. There were no casualties in the incident and police reinforcements were called to the scene. According to the police, as the police officer was trying to locate the director of the educational institution, a crowd began to gather around the volunteer was standing next to their car and began hurling stones at him. The police officers left the scene without being able to have the school closed. The Jerusalem Post. The personal information of about 140,000 confirmed coronavirus patients in Israel was sent to the Shin Bet, Israel's security agency, without notifying them, in a clear and serious violation of several privacy laws. In a letter sent to Health Minister Yuli Edelstein on Friday, chairman of the Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, member of Knesset Zvi Hauser, Derech Eretz, referred to the unusual incident as a serious malfunction and said that it will have an unbearable negative effect on the public's trust in the regime. I-24 News. The United Arab Emirates has suspended the visa waiver agreement with Israel, initially set to come into effect in February until July 1, 2021, Israel's foreign ministry announced. Until July 2021, Israelis looking to travel to the UAE will have to obtain entry visas, unless notified otherwise. The same rules apply to Emiratis planning a trip to Israel. The decision followed complaints from health officials, while Israeli diplomats are said to have opposed it, wary of damaging the nascent formal ties between the two countries. The Times of Israel. A growing number of ultra-Orthodox Torah schools are reopening despite regime directives to remain shuttered as coronavirus infection rates remain at all-time highs, according to multiple reports. These join institutions of more extreme sects that have refused to close throughout the lockdown. The Haaretz report said the limited opening of more schools would likely have a domino effect and lead to more and more returning to studies in the coming days.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we have reached the section where Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, talks about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha. And we were discussing about the quality of controlling gluttony or eating less. And we discussed about this previously. We defined the terms properly to the degree required. And of course, we were discussing about the spiritual effects of eating too much. And we reached this phrase or this section where we were discussing about the fact that if you overeat, then the sexual desires become more, like they begin to enliven and rather become stronger. So a person needs to control the desires, especially for young people who have not married. We discussed about the ways to control the food intake for this regard. So not eating too much and controlling it in a way that controlling food intake in a way that you don't eat until you are completely full. Rather, you stop eating when you are still a little bit hungry, which will actually give you the ability to train yourself properly.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of the other effects that are there one of the spiritual effects that are there of overeating is that a person will not be able to pray properly or nicely or continuously. We have a narration from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam where he reportedly says from Nabi Isa alayhi salam, the Prophet Isa alayhi salam, he told the children of Israel, that means the Jews, that do not eat too much, because if you eat too much, you will become a person who likes to sleep too much, or you begin sleeping too much. And whoever sleeps too much, the amount of prayer that he performs becomes less. And whoever's prayer becomes less, he will be written to be amongst those who are ghafil, those who are oblivious. So this is a very beautiful narration. it shows the effect of eating too much on the sleep of a person. And of course, this is proven that a person who's, you know, especially at night, eats with a full stomach, sleeps on a full stomach, definitely you will not be able to wake up properly. You will not get a good sleep also, because a lot of the blood vessels will be concentrating on digesting the food. And there are different effects. I mean, these are some things that are physical. Also, there are spiritual effects of this. So, when a person's sleep becomes more, then he cannot pray a lot. This is a very subtle point here. That, see, because when a person sleeps, especially at night, when he sleeps a lot, therefore, he cannot wake up early on time to pray. And one of the best times to pray is early morning or even before sunrise, of course, before sunrise and even before the time, the Fajr time, the prayer time. These are the best times for prayer. I'll explain shortly after the break.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, as Imam says here, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says that Nabi Isa alayhi salam told the children of Israel that there is a connection between eating too much and sleeping too much and the amount of time you spend on prayer. See, at the daytime, because of being involved in a lot of activities, you know, finding provision, working hard, helping others, there is, you know, practically very little time to pray. Unless someone is so strong spiritually that while he's doing those actions, his heart is illuminated and is effulgent with prayer and you know, connection with God. But this is not very common. Normally, when people are doing their work, they don't know, they even forget God, you know, and their relationship with God. The best times are the nights, especially the very early mornings before sunrise and before the Fajr prayer, where a person gets the opportunity to feel that connection with God, because everything is calm and quiet, as if he gets in touch with the unity. See, this is something that a person should work hard to achieve. But if a person does not control their food intake, then there is a domino effect. The domino effect is that you get lesser time to pray to your Lord. This is something amazing that one of the stories, Sheikh Ansari, you know, is a very great mujtahid. He wanted some water and he asks his helper to go and get some water for him. By the time he goes to get that water, he had kept it, you know, somewhere underground so that it cools down. By the time he brings the water, Sheikh Ansari begins to pray his prayer. And he gets such a wonderful connection with God that he spends like, I think, 1 hour praying. By that time, the water had become warm again. So he had to send the water back down in the underground so that it becomes cooler. So you see, these little times of prayer become very less at the daytime. Instead, if we could spend those times in the night, if we control our food intake, would be quite beneficial. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us achieve these levels. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال هناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.